Welcome to the Legally Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Hanna. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Brooks. Tom is an award-winning author, public speaker, policy advisor, the UK's only professor of law and government, president of the Society of Legal Scholars, and the Dean of Durham Law School at Durham University, which is where our producer, Hannah Foley, read law. If that wasn't impressive enough, Tom has held various appointments over the 11 law schools and universities, including Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Oxford University. Tom has published a number of works, including his award-winning book in 2016, Becoming British, UK Citizenship Examined. Tom regularly appears in the media, writes for columns for the Daily Telegraph, The Guardian, The Independent, Labour List, and The Times. So, a very, very warm welcome, Tom.
Oh, wow. What else do I have to do after an introduction like that? I'm just going to not live up to my billing. But thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
No, it's an absolute honor to have you on the show. And before we dive into all your amazing achievements and legal experiences to date, we do have a customary icebreaker question here on the Legally Speaking Podcast, which is, on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very real, how real would you rate the reality hit series Suits in terms of its reality of the law?
Oh, 2? not very high.
Yeah, I think 2 is a fair answer, particularly people in the law and practicing in the law. I think just the ability to close out motions in a heartbeat just doesn't exist. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us a bit about your family background and upbringing.
Wow. So in brief, I don't know how exceptional things really were for me. I was a very happy one of five kids to great parents. Dad ran a bike store, some bicycles. Mom was a science school teacher. Both had a love of science. Both terribly disappointed that none of the five of us got into science ourselves. And in the United States, in New Haven, Connecticut, is the area I'm from. The Brooks side of my family has been there since the 1660s, and the other side even earlier. So I'm parts of me are very, very American, as it were. And ultimately did a music degree as my first thing. But I then got into political and legal philosophy. Never had ambition or plans to leave the United States in any kind of long-term sense. It to some degree, just kind of happened, to summarize that part of my life in a nutshell. And then to some degree, kind of fell into a deep kind of love for a long time of political legal philosophy. That's where a lot of my stuff is, but being more practice-oriented. And then opportunities across the pond and make my life like my peers. So my upbringing was, I was not surrounded by lawyers. I wouldn't say I knew any lawyers, or I certainly didn't know them as lawyers. I might have known them as neighbors or friends, but I didn't know them for their legal work. And all of it was a bit mystical. I was just fascinated by what is a right, what are liberties, what are the principles by which someone can be found guilty of a crime, and how do we punish it? Just kind of, and then issues about what is an immigrant, how do we judge for citizenship? I'm telling you what you wanted to hear. But that was the kind of stuff that kind of got me over here. And then I then peeled the onion back and tried to see more layers. And here I am, Dean of Durham.
And so you touched on it there, but you originally started your academic career lecturing in political thought. And then what made you transition into the law?
So there's lots of talk about disciplinary boundaries, about the difference between, say, so what is the difference, for example, between a political philosopher in a philosophy department versus a political theorist in a political politics department? Answer seems to be that the philosophers tend to look at issues and people who are still alive, and the people in politics department tend to study people who have ideas in government who are all dead. So, Hobbes, Plato, Machiavelli are right from the politics side. Then it comes to law, and think about legal philosophy. Well, who are the heroes and heroines of that trade? Well, the classics, in the good old days, they were in law schools. The oldest law school in America is not far from my hometown, Litchfield. Now a museum. I warmly recommend listeners to check it out. Not Yale, not Harvard, not Columbia, Litchfield. Kind of classic stuff about what is law, what is our obligation to the rights of the individual versus the state, where you draw lines, and so on and so forth. was drawn by folks who are studied by both political theorists and politics departments and legal philosophers in law schools. For me, it's pretty much interchangeable. It's pretty much a seamless kind of web, a longer conversation, not much of a difference. Though, you know, you asked about my coming to the law. What are the gripes I've had in my work, especially in work around punishment or around immigration from a philosophical perspective, is there is the thinking about what those good principles should be and how it might work in some ideal space that my training, you know, does a lot of. But, of course, we're also not talking about pie in the sky. We're talking about things that are real. And one of my big criticisms were is that people are talking about these things in too abstract, with absolutely no relation to practice. So I've been kind of keen to kind of be more practice-oriented as a kind of legal, political, philosophy background. And so being in a law school has been, you know, that was the kind of natural progression for me. And then being dean was another thing on top of that.
And that's right. And so you've been dean, acting as dean of Durham Law School, one of the top law schools in the world for 5 years. Tell us more about the strategy behind Durham's management.
Well, so when I came to Durham, when I came to the UK, I never heard of Durham. So that's not uncommon for a lot of Americans. It's still a challenge the university has, to be honest about it. And I'm trying to do something about it now as an American, trying to make more Americans know that we exist. So I didn't know about the school until I came to the UK. And then when I kind of took over, as it were, there was a legacy, many legacies. One that jumped out to me was that it was small compared to other law schools. So when I joined, there might have been 100 or so students in a cohort. The staffing, you know, grew in a big expansion to be 32 or 33 full-time permanent staff. Harvard's got 6 or so different buildings housing their offices and stuff in comparison to relatively small compared to others in the UK, which will typically be more 70, 80 staff or more for the big boys and girls in the Russell Group and so on. And so what's been different, so I inherited that and also a department that was very traditional in terms of focus on the qualifying law degree for England and Wales. And there were other bits and bobs there that were there too and doing incredibly well and taking various great international lawyers, great other stuff that's not on the QLD, the qualified QLD. So that was wonderful. But very, how do I call this? Very British academic department, by which I mean, I don't say plopped on the hill and comfortable with itself. That is untrue and a gross mischaracterization. But not as outward-facing, let's just say, as law schools in other countries like mine. So I warned people, if they had an American dean as the dean, I was going to act like an American dean. And I was not going to sit in my office where I am now. I was going to be out and about. I was going to go meet people. I was going to meet firms and chambers and all the rest of it. I was going to be in there. And I was going to take employability to new heights. You know, what are people looking for? What are they not looking for? What is the success rates that we actually have? Not that we think we've got because of one or two conversations. What's the data? And I was data driven on this. And then thinking through also what the gaps and opportunities were. So kind of a final point, if I can. So when I started, again, we're smaller, a decision was made by the university executive that did not involve my input to double the school in terms of the staff, academic staff, or faculty, if the Americans are listening. So Americans call academic staff faculty. So I'm doing some cross-cultural communication. So hiring 30, 35 people and, you know, more or less in five or so years. Well, no one's doing that. So how does that look? You know, Yale ain't doing that. Columbia's like, I know, I was there. You know, they're not doing this kind of stuff. So then you got a chance to remake a department. And so finally, at last, you know, 10 minutes later, answer your question. The strategy was to look at where our strengths were that were strategic and expand more on that. So I saw quickly that commercial corporate law is a thing that not all law schools have much of. We had a big number. We made it our biggest group. It's where most of our students go. We're most successful in students working in a commercial corporate, broadly construed area. So we're going to kind of be more gung-ho about that, take that to a new level. There's other things that we should and can do as well. Came across to me very clearly that a lot of law firms were doing increasing amounts of work and setting up offices or partnerships, et cetera, in East Asia. I'm talking China, I'm talking Singapore, Malaysia. And it came up in conversation. So what does it mean to be a better school? What does it mean to have a good strategy? What does it mean? What are the gaps other than just kind of being really super good at something? We got one more awesome human rights lawyer than you. Or what is this, what does this mean? Where do you go? How do you direct yourself? And I saw that Chinese law was a particular thing to leap at, something that the top 20 law schools, not necessarily all the top 100, but the top 20, this is a picture that they've got. This is the picture that all the top firms are going to do more work here. And that was kind of a winner. And kind of a broader global legal education, not just being narrow. Qualifying for England and Wales is great. You got to do it. That's essential. But doing that's not enough.
Yeah.
That's a strategy. That's not enough. Being more global.
Love it. Love it. Durham Law School has been ranked as third in the UK for world-leading research impact. I think fifth in the Complete University Guide in 2020, in the top 50 world university rankings by subject in 2021.
So you're making me blush.
All of these things are massive, right? And I think as a dean of Durham Law School, you lead, and you touched on the recruitment part there, you lead on the biggest growth in the school's 50-year history, increasing academic staff, I believe, from 42 to 75, building new critical mass and key areas, and really improving the school's research, which you touched on. Can you just tell us a bit more about that in particular? Because I think that's a really important point.
So what does it mean to have great research? What does it mean to be highly regarded in these things, other than kind of spending sufficient amounts of time developing new thoughts that someone publishes somewhere? Part of it is having kind of some architecture, having structures in place. So mentoring of all staff, including me. I have a research mentor. The dean was in the mix as well, not just early career staff. Everyone was to be treated equally with that. That we made more use of and engaged more concertedly with various bits of support for grants and other things that the university had. But in terms of kind of the big topics and the things, one thing that stood out for me is in a situation like this, in trying to explain to people who are not in the staff why we're any good, why they should care. And when I was kind of doing my chats to the firms, doing various interviews, doing open days, speaking to new students, to say things like, and we have more people to write books that you might not find at your local bookshop, that we publish in journals that are too expensive for a non-university to afford, that you might not have heard. It's kind of be publishing in highly regarded things, whatever they are, according to whoever, is the kind of thing that everyone expects is happening. We publish on this, we publish on that. Every university is publishing stuff. There's nothing unique about that. I wanted to push colleagues into doing more impact engagement and stuff. Because to say that someone has a new book and it's really powerful and interesting, it might be. And the people that come to the school are smart. And our graduates are smart. And they know more about the law than I do in areas. I specialize in immigration stuff. But, some super capable people. So I'm not, saying anything other than that. But you only get so far. If you instead say, that the law has changed because of the people here in the school, that kind of key things in the news has changed because of graduates in the school, because of people working in the school, because of things connected to the school. During Brexit, for example, I commented to the Electoral Commission changing the question to the Leave Remain thing. So I'm one of, I think, two academics quoted in that. So that's in the referendum question. You then have the Member of Parliament putting the bill through for withdrawal was graduates, then Solicitor General, now Lord Chancellor, was a Durham graduate. That first case about did Theresa May need Parliament to pull the trigger, that was heard by the Supreme Court, as you know, and one of the members of the Supreme Court was our first graduate on the Supreme Court. When the other case happened about prohibition of Parliament in Scotland, that would involve someone who was a Durham Law graduate, won that case in Scotland. Case goes to the Supreme Court. Another graduate of the law school The second woman on the Supreme Court was on hearing that case. Then we had the internal market bill. The senior government advisor resigned over concerns that also a Durham graduate. So I quite liked, you're reading about Brexit. It's kind of a big thing. Sounds like it means something in the legal world to people. And at every stage, whether they're commenting, whether they're decision makers, whether they be politicians, whether they be lawyers, again, my fusion of law and politics to some degree, in my own mind, my own work, kind of all came together on both sides. You know, people who are trying to, so-called get it done, whatever that means, it hasn't done yet, by the way, or those who had reservations or on the main side. Both sides had Durham people, sometimes in the same college, which was also fascinating sociologically to see. And that kind of brought things alive. They thought Durham is then a place that they're not just kind of doing good because the numbers looked good. They're not just kind of publishing stuff that people like because, whatever it says in there, everyone has something like that. But impact, changing things, being on the telly, being on the radio, being there, whether it be staff, whether it be graduates, and being aware that they're Durham people. That, I think, was what kind of takes it up a notch. That's one of the things I see as a difference, like, say, back when I'm back home. People have been involved in kind of key decision-making who are there to advise students and so on. And their staff, not everybody, not for everyone. You know, there is a point of great scholarship of the lone scholar. So that's hugely important. That used to be me. But people are out there changing the world, as it were, or being part of that. And being able to show your little boy and girl, your child coming studying with us, or working with us. If you're law firms, we're connected to these people. We are those people. We can show you where things are going. We're involved in these debates, these conversations. That is an X factor. That's the thing. Now you're in the realm of stuff where it's hard to put price tags on. But just struck me as kind of in the job, going out there, being in the field, speaking to folks at the top. And what do other law schools in the very top, what are they doing? How do they manage themselves? They do good stuff. How do you kind of really mark yourself out? It struck me that was the way.
And you mentioned it there, and let's just dig a bit deeper, because you've met these law firms that are your future lawyers that they end up at. What do you think are some of the key differences between law school and private practice? And how can law schools such as Durham alter the learning model to best prepare students for the career in practice?
Well, there's lots of differences. I'll try to stick with some things that are fairly, kind of the less obvious. Law firms, one thing they have in common is they're effectively only able to effectively charge or draw people in to the degree that people have faith, confidence in what the bill is. People will decide to spend their fee, whether it be through the UK as a British citizen, the British system, don't get me started on that, or as overseas students with the overseas fees differential. So they're not going to invest one way or the other in going somewhere unless they thought they were going to get something out of that, whether it be feeling good or what does it mean to satisfy a customer? Does it mean that they have to be better off materially or well-being or other things or all of them? Who knows? That's in the eye of the people. But, they vote with their feet. They're impressed by the brand, what you have on offer. Then they're going to keep coming. And it's been a very big strength. You couldn't double the staff here and frankly pay for it if you didn't attract students of the same quality in larger numbers to cover that. And our, cohort of students has grown to compensate for the extra staff, but that was always fine. That was never a problem. And so having that strong brand is very big. And the same thing go for the firms. The less you've heard of them, the less you think of them, the more difficult life will be in general. So there's things like that in common, but also there's kind of what they're doing. Of course, the firm may want to change the world, and I suspect that those at the very top, they'll be interested in doing some, maybe more proactively, more aggressively, some kind of pro bono like stuff, getting their name attached to some kind of big things for the free publicity, for the connection, for the and so on from that. Much as, say, I described, ourselves, being, everyone has to teach contract law, teach you what it is today. But getting people who know about where it's going in the future, being involved in those conversations and show, because once students graduate, they're done learning with us. They're off into the world, and the law isn't usually static. At least not for very long. So getting people prepared to engage with that and do that kind of thing is hugely important. So you've kind of different angles coming up from different ways. And I think, you know, one other kind of crucial thing is, you know, for us to survive, as it were, it is broadly about having something that kids want to do. You hear lots of things about, you know, non-law degrees and, you know, Mickey Mouse degrees, all this stuff. We need to stop this and stop that. And yet somehow have a market in things. And like, well, if the kids want to do it and they feel this is worth it to them, then there's a part of me that is very strongly libertarian and more relaxed. But with law firms, you know, they might know rules better than anyone, but you know, they might have the best people for doing something, but people don't have confidence in that. You know, if people don't buy it effectively, then you know they have that business facing thing, which is, you know, we can be as smart as we want to be, but if no one thinks we're very smart or has a problem with what we're doing, then you know, but we've, you know, the clients are different, but a lot of the model is the same. There is something, Robert, about what I think kind of like what kind of makes out better law schools in general that I've tried to orient ourselves to. And this is a very, very short story, but it's a beatsy. But so here it is. So there's, you know, the first law school, or one of the first law schools, at least in Europe, Western Europe, was Bologna. And what you saw kind of traditionally with law schools, the purpose was to give a qualification. They were places of learning. It was very much a scholastic experience. And outsiders to the continental civil law tradition often think of it very kind of a scholastic thing. Anyway, so it had that kind of mentality. There's a legacy to that. You know, it is true that when I've spoken to partners, I've visited all the Magic and Silver Circle and others, boutique and in London and elsewhere, and in the United Kingdom, I have not yet met somebody who has met another dean of another law school yet, outside of a graduation ceremony, usually the one they had 10, 15, 20, 25 more years ago. I tend to be it. The only university people most law firms tend to see is someone from the career service. You know, they only see someone, an academic from the department, when they're doing a campus visit, in the rare moments that they are. And, you know, they'll often have lots of teams, but not everyone's on every visit. So, you know, the one that they're involved, they might pop in, see what's going on, have some chance encounters, but that'll be it. There weren't proactive people coming to them was a new one. And when I've gone across continental Europe, that is also the case that most have not, with exceptions, but most aren't doing that thing, really much at all. In the United States, of course, it's still opposite. So now I'm telling you about Litchfield. So Litchfield was started in the lounge of a bloke who was a very experienced lawyer in a new country. And law was not a part of any university in America at the time. It was just founded and just coming to be. Law was an apprenticeship. Law was finding someone to let you in to see what's going on and learning the trade firsthand by doing. And this guy in the lounge for a fee, he taught two former vice presidents, including Aaron Burr, famous with the whole Hamilton thing, taught them by himself originally all areas of law. And it was kind of like an extra finishing school for those who could afford it from surrounding areas to go out and practice. And it was always practice facing. And so in the United States today, you see the legacy of that too. It is a graduate degree. Law schools are largely to a large degree autonomous from the rest of the university. The head of a law school will sit alongside the president, vice president equivalent of the executive. Not true in Britain, not true in most other places where we're treated like any other department under wider faculties, typically with much less power, much less resource, much less budget control, and so on than the Americans. And the American degree is aimed at practitioners. It is about getting you to pass the bar exam. Doing various law clinics is an essential part of what it is from the start. And most law schools will be about getting you to pass the bar exam and off you go, thank you very much. And the very top places, the very top places do a combination of these things. The highest levels of the scholastic, nerdy, in-depth kind of academic stuff for its academic sake, addressing problems because they're interesting, and this kind of stuff. There'll be a group of people, maybe half the department, at least a third doing that. And then the others will be the more practitioner base from law and politics, who will typically, at the best places, will not be just one jurisdiction. There'll be something Asian law. There'll be other areas of the globe as well. Not a lot, but there'll be something there. And so their graduates don't just learn how to pass the New York State Bar Exam, whatever that means, and go out there and have some fun, but they get their students ready for jobs at the top international firms, where, of course, have the biggest jobs, the most training contracts, and so on and so forth, kind of expand their boundaries and also more global. And they have more international students going to those places, to the Yales, the Harvards, the Columbias, than the places across the road, I won't name them for various reasons, that have much less folks from overseas. So difference between, I think, law schools and firms, but also between, I think, some you know, most law schools and the ones that are at the very top. And final comment, if I can, is that that also is the same difference you see, again, going back lots of similarities, with law firms. You know, the very best law firms, you know, are the ones with the biggest reputation, you know, that Magic Circle in particular, but not just them. What are they? They're international. They're everywhere. They have global reach. They can support you with your case that you're doing, you know, something here, but they can also do things seemingly everywhere. And you know, they're ready for that kind of that outlook, that kind of regard, that kind of reach. And that's true of the elite law schools. That's true of the elite law firms. And that's what makes them elite. It's not just that they've been around a while. Not just there's a bit of money floating around. Lots of places with money floating around. It's how it's used and it's what they do that I think makes them different.
Love it. Really appreciate that. What I want to ask is, obviously, with 2021 being the year of the introduction of the SQE, phasing out the LPC, one of the biggest changes to the profession in years, what is your opinion, as concisely as you can, because I know it's topical and debatable, on the SQE, and are you worried about the new route could not provide trainees with the necessary skills they need to be a solicitor?
Well, I think the SQE as a thing is a mistake in my personal private judgment. I'm representing only myself, all the qualifications as a personal opinion, and so on and so forth. And I think it's a mistake for a number of reasons. And let me do so, let's say so in a constructive but short manner. So one thing to say is, you know, if someone would say to me, look, Tom, do you think it's time we had a refresh of what law students need to know? Do you think that we should look again at this? Do you think that it's worth asking the question or not? And I think, oh, absolutely, no, 100% behind it. I'm evangelical about the need to kind of relook at this. So I don't think it's in stone. It should be in stone all for that. But then the question you might ask could be, you know, so all right, so if it's worth kind of asking the question and looking again, I think, you know, do you also think, you know, things would be specified a bit better and so on? So, well, yeah. I mean, at the moment, for a qualifying law degree, it's pretty bare, threadbare. The requirements of university, you know, kind of like, I paraphrase, but, you know, do enough public law, do enough EU con, do enough tort. Which cases are enough? Do you have to have cases? Can you do it only philosophically? The philosophy of contract law, does that count as having substantial, sufficient contract law for purposes of a QLD or not? There's a lot of things there that I think, you know, in Scotland, the qualifying, that is spelled out much more and addresses that. And the answer is, no, you can't just do a philosophy of it. Some of it's all right, but, you know, there are certain things that one needs to know through different areas. And my personal view would be I would have liked something a bit more directed, frankly, a bit more, perhaps a bit more heavy-handed. I would be open-minded about. And then maybe even something kind of radical about what we ought to do. Why I think all this stuff is a terrible mistake in a nutshell. This is supposed to open things up. You know, the argument is that, you know, folks of different backgrounds not have the opportunity to be, you know, to work in law, and that this will somehow make it better and make things kind of more equal or something. So there'd be a higher quality of the people coming through, and be a more diverse group of people coming through as well. In terms of quality, you don't need a law degree anymore to get through or any university level training in law at all. Does that mean that there'll be better lawyers? I'm all about people doing other subjects. I think the GDL is awesome. So I think that, you know, people, you know, doing different routes is great and a good thing for all parts of the law profession. And I don't think you own, you know, you need more LOB or less LOB, but that there would be like, could be none. That's not even important. And that the exam will answer all. And a multiple choice exam where there is a correct answer to, you know, and only one to legal questions. And that is the barometer of of whether or not people are ready to be good lawyers, and not, you know, handling the usual cases we deal with in mooting, where, you know, what is the best answer? How do you argue that case? How do you build up the case? Where a lot of things is applying stuff where things can, there's two sides or more. And it's not always clear, and dealing with uncertainty and so on, that that's not a skill that lawyers need to have to qualify, to forever be a qualified licensed solicitor, you know, as I see the rules applying. This seems to me to be stark raving, barking mad. And, you know, and I constantly challenge the SRA on social media, in person, when I would be at different events and elsewhere, that they've got some question, or anyone has any questions about Durham standards, or I would say, you know, please have a visit. I'd love to have a chat and open the books. But you know, it hasn't happened during my tenure. So that's that one element. Then the other thing about there kind of being a more diversity in things, you know, and it seems, you know, what's the problem here? The problem seems to be with the SRA regulated LPC. And I didn't think, well, hang on a second. If you guys are overseeing the LPC, you think the LPC isn't working right? Or there's some issues around things with this, or so it seems, then why are you going there? You know, why are you restricting what could be, you know, why are you having more control of this or changing this or improving that experience? Why are you just kind of dropping the thing you are kind of overseeing to have something in a test that someone else is going to oversee to do what didn't happen? I'm a bit perplexed by some of this stuff, you know, and the thought that there's like not enough law graduates. Most people who sadly get a qualifying law degree, of course, don't work in law. Many don't want to work in law, but many can't even if they want to. So should there be more entry points to have even more people get in? Or one consultation, I had someone during the consultation say to me, Tom, well, we can't have them, can't have everyone Durham, Oxford, or Cambridge graduates. We need to have, or another kind of Russell Group places. You know, we need to have kind of a big spread. It's like, oh, hang on a second. You know, diversity is not, you know, one person from this law school, one person from that law school, one person from another law school. I mean, that's not diversity. And the top people from those places might have all gone to the same school. They just went to different law schools. And that's not diversity. You know, and I think, you know, yeah, so I think it's not going to lead to a higher quality of people. A lot of firms are doing blind CVs where it's taking the universities out anyway. And at the end of the day, just the fact, you look at the top places for employability, Oxford, Cambridge, yourselves, Bristol is also great, Nottingham, all law schools are great, I'm putting this list, they're all great and wonderful. But, you know, those who are at the top of the employability rankings, I'm thinking about the Chamber Students Directory in particular, you know, what do they have in common? They have a tutoring system, very small groups teaching, and is that going to change? No. You know, and, you know, getting kind of more, and others who are different situations, often have different groups and different ways, staff student ratio, resource from the universities. There's other factors going in. Is the SPA exam going to do this? I think not. It was an opportunity missed because, frankly, I think that, you know, of course, genuinely, this is me, Tom, speaking, not just President SLS, but I think genuinely, you know, there is some inspiring stuff at every level, you know, from the top to the bottom, law schools, incredible stuff happening at law schools, really working hard to attract students and doing a great job with it. And, you know, there's an opportunity to kind of talk about how we could come together and do something new and more exciting and make for better students, make for better legal education. And I think, frankly, almost everyone, if not everyone, was up for it. But they then have this.
Well, time will tell. And I really appreciate you sharing your view on that. I just want to finally ask, you know, you're no stranger to the media. You've been highly recognized as a public speaker. You've featured on Newsnight, BBC News, CNN, Sky News, just to name a few. So can you tell our listeners what sort of things you tend to get interviewed for?
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. So one of the main things I tend to be picked up for was originally immigration stuff. Immigration, at least was, it's not at the moment, which I think is probably a good thing. what was the kind of hot issue of greatest concern. And we were seeing almost annual new acts going through Parliament, tweaking bits of immigration law. And so having someone who understands how the whole system works and an immigrant voice was something that I was very keen to be that immigrant on your television, on your radio, elsewhere, in the print media, to speak about rules that I had experienced, that I knew about, because you have an enormous amount of pundits who are not immigrants themselves. They never immigrated anywhere other than to go on holiday with the account. And certainly didn't teach the stuff, write about the stuff, live the stuff. Yet they were the ones, taking up all the airwaves. They're the ones, we've been hearing for years about, launching a points-based immigration system. And then, and it started allegedly after Brexit. Yeah, it started over 10 years ago, mate, under New Labour. Ask anyone with a Tier 2 visa, working in law firms, listening to this podcast. Still, because it didn't change. They tweaked a bit how they apply it, but it's the same thing. So it was kind of on immigration originally, and then when immigration became a big thing with the whole Brexit, votes and what to do about it, that's where I was in particularly high demand. And it was fun. It was fun. It still is fun. I still get, there's still a lot going on.
Well, we look forward to seeing you on our TVs much, much more in the future. And so that kind of brings to the close our fascinating conversation, Tom. So if people want to get in touch with you about anything we've discussed, what's the best way for them to do that? Feel free to shout out any web links or relevant social media that you use. And we'll also promote and share that with this episode for you as well.
I suppose the easiest way to get in touch with me is either through my website, tombrooks.oneword.info, or on Twitter, tom_brooks. I can't spell either of my names. Americans, we can't spell anything, so it's Tom with an H, Brooks without an E. But there you are. That's the easy way to get in touch. And yeah, we'd enjoy it.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Wishing you lots of continued success with all of your wider pursuits. But from all of us, over and out.
Thanks so much. Cheerio.
This week's review comes from Vera. Vera says, COVID has helped me catch up on all the things I love doing, including listening to podcasts. What makes the Legally Speaking podcast special is that they interview a range of people from different professional backgrounds. That way, I can learn more about being a lawyer in all departments. Thanks so, so much for your review, Vera. Words can't express how much that means to all of us here on the show. We really appreciate each and every individual loyal listener that supports us on our mission of wanting to be the number one podcast for the legal and wider communities. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Legally Speaking podcast. If you enjoyed the show and want to help support us, remember to leave us a rating and review on Apple iTunes. You can also support the show and gain exclusive benefits, bonus content, and much more by signing up to our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Legally Speaking podcast. Thanks for listening.